Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, academic lectures in business and economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 4 for autumn semester 2015. Lecture 2, delivered on August 24, 2015. The title of this lecture is Special Topics, the Federal Reserve.
Today, special topic, interest rates and the Federal Reserve. This crosses in and out of the textbook, and it is a little bit of preliminary introduction to some extent, repeating what you should have learned in macroeconomics, but probably it was either summary or it just went in and you got rid of it as you purged your files in your brain as soon as the semester was over. And another reason I'm doing this is before we go any further, is that, as I had mentioned, you'll find that most business textbooks take a conservative sort of lean in their thinking, which is fine. But when you get into these finance textbooks, I've reviewed like 10 before I selected the one we're using. And this, and almost all of them, ignored anything that had to do with the government, other than for laws like Frank Dodd and Sarbanes-Oxley. They didn't explain a crucial role that the government has, for good or bad, in how financial markets work. Specifically on how they affect interest rates, which pretty much drive a lot of what's going on in an economy, especially with respect to the stock market and all of that. So with that in mind, I have to fill in a blank that the textbook just kind of like, oh, well, there's no really need for government. We're not going to talk about the government's role in interest rates and how they affect stock prices and all of that. Well, right now we're seeing a great example of that. Anyone, if you're a news hound, what's been happening with the stock market over the past few trading days? A thousand, well, yeah, essentially it's been flushed down the toilet. Now, the conventional wisdom is this is because of problems that are happening on the other side of the world, in China. Yes, but those are problems that we had a hand in allowing to develop over many years, and now it's coming to a head. I wrote about it in the late 20-aughts, 20-zeros, that sooner or later the Chinese game they were playing with their economy to make it burn so fast, so incredibly well, was going to come back and bite them, and here it is. It happened a little bit later than I would have expected, but we had a role in having that happen. Here's the basic outline of it. And I'm going to give you a couple of articles to read and a video about how the Federal Reserve works. So you'll have some backup for what's going on here. There was a theory that developed some years ago. Back in the 1990s, there were a couple of groups, neoconservative and neoliberal groups, that had an idea that if, instead of trying to break the back of a communist country like China, the way we had with Russia through extraordinary military spending, which forced them to spend a lot on their military, which finally caused the country to fold, why don't we do it another way with China? The way that was proposed was to induce them to move to market reforms. In other words, stop being so centrally planned. Let the economy grow on its, do its own thing, enjoy the benefits of free markets. In that way, the theory went, we could, this kind of market reform would allow for the growth of a middle class. People would begin to make more money. Entrepreneurs would not be forced by the state to give all their money to the state. They would earn money that they would get to keep. As that middle class developed, they would, that economic freedom that they had experienced, along with the material pleasures of having some money, would induce them to start to demand political freedom. And over a period of time, that political freedom would bubble up and force the fall of the communist gerontocracy at the top of the empire in China. That was the theory. In other words, instead of having an arms race and seeing who went bankrupt first, why don't we have an economic race and let them build an economy, encourage them to market reforms, and then through that, they would eventually give up the ways of communism and they would become more like capitalists like we are. That was the idea. That was the original idea. So, in order to help them do this, the Chinese and the American exchange rate was 8.26 yuan to one US dollar. And the Chinese pegged it there. See, normally currencies float against each other. They go up and down based upon the relative strengths of the economies, the interest rates in each of the economies. But China wanted to peg its interest rate at this incredibly aggressively low level against the American dollar. And that we let it happen because we knew that this way, the Chinese, even though probably, if you were to talk a free market exchange rate, you were talking more like 250 to the American dollar. By having it three times what it was supposed to be, that meant that goods coming from China would be three times as cheap as they would have been if it had been a floating exchange rate with global forces buying and selling of currencies based on economic conditions were in play. So, in other words, you sell a toaster for, you're a Chinese merchant, you sell a toaster for, you want to sell it for $2 and 250 yuan. That's what you want to sell it for. Well, when you sell it here, we buy it, but the problem is, not a problem for you, because when the dollar comes back over to the People's Bank of China, the People's Bank of China gives you 8.26 yuan for that dollar, for that toaster that you wanted to sell for a dollar. You were willing to take 250 because that was purchasing power parity, but the Chinese government printed more than three times as many of those yuan and gave it to you. Well, that was just incredible. You began to bring your prices down aggressively to the point where essentially American goods could not compete against Chinese goods because they were so cheap, because you didn't really need 8.26 yuan. You could drop your price back down and we would buy it. Incredibly cheap stuff. We allowed this pegging, this currency peg, to happen because that would cause the Chinese economy to grow like a wildfire, and it did. By the time we're talking about the end of the 1990s into the early 2000s, the Chinese economy was growing at staggering speed because their goods were so cheap here, we were buying enormous amounts of those goods. So in other words, if I were to draw this as a pair of countries and the U.S., there are goods coming back, going into China, we've got goods going to China, and then they have, for those goods, we pay them, they pay us, and for our goods, we pay them. That's what's called the current account. In other words, we exchange goods, and then we collect the currencies. And you don't get dollars, understand that. You get yuan in your country, the bank keeps the dollars. Those are what are called foreign reserves. Okay, so the balance of trade was wildly negative for the United States. They were selling many more goods to us than we were to them because our stuff was three times as expensive there as it should have been. And what we were doing in exchange was We were importing goods and we were exporting American dollars. We became an exporter. That's always been the case around the world. Countries want our currency because it's always been such a strong, stable currency, the rule of law, great capital investment environment, the shining beacon from sea to shining sea and all of that. So, in other words, in the People's Bank of China, these massive foreign reserves of dollars accumulated. The Chinese economy, the GDP, skyrocketed and grew year over year over year because of this pegging of the yuan against the dollar. We allowed it to happen. We just sat back because we figured as this economy is growing, the people are going to make more money. They're going to finally say enough of your nonsense with your communist system and all that, and they will overthrow the government or force reform, incredible reform on the government in terms of political freedom. Okay, that's great. But the story changed in the 2000s because we said there had been a recession. There wasn't. We said there was a real serious recession in 2002 and 2003. No, there wasn't. As a matter of fact, the original data of the Fed showed that there was no recession. Now they've altered the data to make it look like kind of like there was. But what happened in 2002 and 2003 is there was a claim that we were in such an economically severe recession that we needed to create massive tax cuts, the longest, deepest in American history. Put that together with two theater wars, the war in Afghanistan and the war in Iraq, and you had incredible budget deficits starting to form. Remember at the end of the 90s, we had for the first time in almost in history since we'd been running budget deficits, we had closed our budget deficits and we were running budget surpluses going into the 21st century. They were serious, they were large, and they were growing. We were talking about solving problems that we never could have dreamed of solving. But then those tax cuts and two theater wars happened and we started getting massive budget deficits. Who financed them? The money that we had bought cheap toasters with that was in the People's Bank of China, also in Japan, in Canada, in Europe, all those places that were accumulating U.S. dollars because we bought more from them than we sold to them, they started using those dollars to lend our government money. Not just our government. We're talking about home mortgages. We're talking about all kinds of things to make us feel better than we really were. Student loans, home mortgages, auto loans, you name it. But mostly to pay for the massive budget deficits, the U.S. Treasury needed to borrow massive amounts of money. Well, there it was. This is called the current account. We ran a trade deficit. This is called the capital account. Now, you notice that a flow like this has two parts. It goes both ways. In the current account, we exported dollars to import cheap goods. In the long-term account, the capital account, we imported dollars to pay for our debt so we could borrow massive amounts of money. And what we did in return for that debt is we just signed over future obligations to you and to your children and all those people. Essentially, yeah, we owe money and it'll be our kids' problem to pay the money and the interest and all of that. So you had this two-way flow. So notice that the reasoning behind allowing the pegging of the currency to happen changed from what was originally a global purpose to a very, very parochial purpose. From trying to bring down China to essentially solving our own problem with having wars and tax cuts and all that kind of stuff. It became a very different game. But one way or the other, we are in it now. Here's the upshot. How does China, is China able to give you that extra money? Three times what you earn for that toaster. They print it, just like we do, just like everyone does. When you pay more for something than you need as a government, you simply print money. And here is the rule. Inflation. Inflation is not the result of greedy companies jacking up their prices, greedy unions demanding ridiculous wage contracts, raising the minimum wage. None of that can create inflation, because if there's a fixed amount of dollars, you put it one place, it'll just disappear from another place. But if you print more dollars, then everyone has more money, and it will just eventually be absorbed into inflation. We did it ourselves. We went crazy in the 60s and 70s just cranking out money. And then we faced at the end of the 70s a severe near hyperinflation because we had done it, and then we had to crack down real hard. We had to claw in the money supply hard, and it drove us into a recession that got a president not reelected and put us into a pretty, as I said, a pretty nasty recession. And so we come to China. The chickens have come home to roost. China, being an authoritarian country, tried to pretend, no, we've got everything under control. There's no problem. And they even said, yeah, we're going to loosen up. We won't peg the yuan anymore. Everyone in the currency market knows darn well they are still pegging it, printing money at an excessive rate so that they can keep giving their merchants more and more money than they need for their products, so that they can keep their aggressive posture in the selling markets, global selling markets, especially to the United States. And they said, oh, no, there's no problem. Well, the roaring was the hints. They're not stupid. They knew something was seriously wrong. 2 years ago, 3 years ago, they saw their housing market, their real estate markets, the price is just going ridiculous. In other words, you had sector inflation, and then it began to spread to other parts of the economy. And being authoritarians, they tried to do what we did once. They tried to make it illegal to raise your prices or something like that. But nevertheless, they knew what had to be done. And the People's Bank of China tried to quietly start clamping down on their money supply, quietly no longer printing too much, quietly trying to claw back that massive, insane liquidity overhang that had been there for so long. Unfortunately, you can't hide economic reality from economies. And finally, the branch is broken. And the Chinese economy, under the increasing interest rates, under the clamped-down money supply, the Chinese economy is beginning to buckle. And when you're talking about an economy that huge, that fast-growing, when it buckles like a car running into a truck on the road. The truck of reality and that car are going to meet, and the car is not going to come out looking pretty, no matter how hard the government of China tried to convince people that, nah, there's not a problem. It's there now. The problem, though, is that you see, as the Chinese economy begins to collapse, well, for us, that's a problem. Because they have all of these dollars. And so their ability to invest is going to be seriously hampered. Their ability to produce will be seriously hampered. And so many of our companies are still over there trying to produce their stuff at cheap rates in China because they outsource there. So we are feeling the global pinch of that economy beginning to spiral in badly. There's a second part to it that's kind of nasty, too, but, you know, there you go. You see, this was where the yuan should have been. The fact that it was up here where they pegged it for so many years, like 20 years, possibly. Well, we would love to have forced them to open, let go, and stop their nonsense with this. Unfortunately, they were pretty resistant to it. And we were hopeful, well, over time, they'll be forced to bring it down and all that kind of stuff. Well, there's a dark side to an economy like China getting extremely damaged and weak. By its nature, a weak economy will tend to have a very cheap currency. So, in other words, our battle to get China to open up and knock off the pegging is going to be defeated, because now that the economy of China is going into a tailspin, their currency is going to naturally become cheaper. Move toward that. That's the backdrop of what's going on. In there is the story of many things that I know you weren't shown in macroeconomics. It's a complicated subject. And try explaining this to your average Joe on the street. And it's just almost impossible to explain this. But one important point about this is the role of central banks. Central banks, in other words, a bank in the middle, sort of like the country's bank, in a way, if you might want to think about it that way. The precursor of these central banks go all the way back to the 1600s in Europe. You see sort of like these banks that were the king's bank or the sovereign's bank or the parliament's bank showing up to try to handle currency. You might not want to call them central banks, but they had the sort of like the precursors of it. By the time we get to the 1800s, countries were formally, by law, recognized creating central banks. In other words, a bank that could handle foreign currency exchange. In other words, if I sold something in France, then when a French person bought it, I would get my dollars. The central bank would take the currency, the French currency, and turn it into dollars for me to have. Because I can't spend a French dollar in the United States. I have to have American dollars. So that was an important thing. As global trade began to pick up in the 1800s substantially, well, there had to be a central bank that could handle the foreign currency and begin to set up these kinds of flows of current and capital accounts. Those central banks also, in some countries, had a role in watching other banks. But here's the deal. The United States turned away from the idea of a central bank for a long, long time. Some of our founding fathers were pretty dead set against a national bank to begin with. And a central bank, that didn't happen. Things changed in the later 1800s. After the Civil War, you had a lot of boom in financial transactions and a lot of scams and a lot of schemers and a lot of bad banks. And you had some bank crashes that harmed a lot of people. In the 1880s, it got to the point where some of the crashes were so widespread, one bank would go under, and then a bad bank would go under, and then good banks would go under because everyone rushed those banks for their money, and they collapsed because they don't have all the money people put in. And you had almost like little mini recessions because of some of these bank crashes in the 1880s and 90s. Finally, during a very brief period of maybe 4 or 5 years, when our government had a liberal tendency in the early 1900s, early 20th century, the Federal Reserve Act was passed. The Federal Reserve Act. The Federal Reserve Act established the Federal Reserve, our central bank of the United States. It was given three jobs. Well, technically, and I'll give you there's a nice video the Fed in St. Louis has produced. And it's kind of cheesy, it's animated, but it explains it really nicely. The country was divided up into 12 regions, 12 districts. and each district would have a district bank of the Fed that would watch over the banks in that district. And then the Fed itself would be overseen by seven governors. Seven governors. Now, one of them would be the chairman. That's not an eighth one. That's one of them. These governors are appointed by the president with the advice and consent of the Senate. And then there would be 12 district banks. Now, each district bank, now, strangely enough, when this was all established, there were so many more people on the East Coast that the districts on the East Coast, like New York, Boston, they're tiny. And the districts out west are huge, which, of course, now that things have changed so much, you got San Francisco Bank is handling a whole lot of stuff because it's got such a massive region. But anyway, the 12 district banks. And each of those district banks has a bank president. Now, I've met two of these bank presidents over my life. These people are, historically, they've been the cream of the crop. The best of the best in finance, just consummate, perfect people. They don't even have sex. Seven governors, 12 district banks. And these are the Federal Reserve. Now, there were three jobs of the Federal Reserve. One was to regulate and supervise the banking system. To regulate and supervise the banking system. Now, the governors do the regulation. The district banks do the supervision. In other words, the governors write the rules, and then the district banks go around and enforce the rules on the banks in their district. Now, we're right near the boundary between two Federal Reserve districts, down south of St. Louis, up north of Chicago. We're in the Chicago, but you go, what is it? I think about 30 minutes south, and you're in the St. Louis district. Now, I take my students and the Illinois State students in finance to the Fed every now and then. The one in Chicago, the one in St. Louis is real open. It's an education kind of thing, and I'll give you the links so that you can go there. They've got games for kids. They've got educational materials for adults. It's a really fun place, and they're very receptive. However, the one in Chicago, I took my students up to the one in Chicago, and it was just like, it was like they were treating us like we were terrorists. They had this big person watching us, guarding us. We wanted to go into the little museum where they show you $1 million, all that kind of stuff. My students are walking in there, and I'm following behind them, and this big woman with a nightstick hits me on the knuckles. You know, ouch, bitch, yeah, that hurt. And, you know, they're so paranoid up there, and they're very unfriendly to student groups. I mean, it was just really not fun at all. But anyway, go to St. Louis if you want to see a Fed where they're a little bit more open. Even there, they act like, you know, someone's going to steal all their money, as if the government has any money right now. Anyway, but look, then it does another thing too. It's the one of the three that almost no one outside of banking has any idea is there. And it's probably the least controversial, the most successful of all of the Fed's operations. The Fed is charged with being a bank for banks. Now, there are private commercial banks that do these services. In other words, if you're a bank, you need a place to deposit your money. And the Fed is one of the places you could do that. You can also go to a commercial bank to do it, but the Fed stands in direct competition with the commercial banks that do it. They are required to constantly be investing in new technologies, and they have to share everything that they develop with the private banks against whom they compete. It has not destroyed the private banking, the commercial banks at all. And someone asked me, well, what's the balance a few years ago? So I called a guy I know at the St. Louis Fed, and I said, How many banks go with private commercial banks, and how many banks go with your Federal Reserve for their checking and banking needs? And he said it was about 65% go with the Fed, about 35% go with private banks. But those private banks make buttloads of money, and the Federal Reserve's operations, as serving as a bank for bank, pour literally tens of billions of dollars into the Treasury every year through what they make on their banking work. And it creates a fosters competition. It makes the fees a lot lower for banks to have banking services. And the technologies, pretty much the Fed is the one who develops all the technologies, like when check scanners came along and all that kind of stuff. That was the Fed stuff. That was the Fed that did all that. Interestingly enough, I wrote an article saying, if you want a solution for the national unavailability of health care, set up a system like the Fed's. It's hugely successful. Have a national health insurance and let it just compete in exactly the same way as the Fed does. Let it compete against private health insurers. And, of course, no one wanted to hear anything about that. Everyone was too hot-headed at the time for a solution like that. But anyway, the third is conducts monetary policy. In other words, it controls the money supply. For almost a century, the Fed had one job, to maintain stability of the price level. In other words, keep inflations and deflations from happening. That was its only job. Keep that money supply growing at the growth rate of the economy. If you grow it too fast, you get inflation. If you grow it too slow, you'll get a deflation. That was its job. Then, in its infinite genius in the 1970s, the Congress said, on number three, it also has a job of helping the economy. So in other words, it had two conflicting directions on three. Maintaining the stability of the aggregate price level means that you don't use the money supply to make the economy get better or to stop an inflation. You leave it alone. You grow it at a strict disciplined rate. But when you are also ordered by law to help the economy, that means you are all kinds of open to having to print excessive amounts of money when there are recessions, which the Fed has done many times, and ultimately, in the end, it had to claw back that money and drive us into recessions in major boom-bust cycles. But there you go. That's how it works. Now, those are the three jobs of the Fed. Let me step back here for a second. On conducting monetary policy, it has three tools. One of its ways it can conduct monetary policy is by changing the required reserve ratio. This is, some people call this the fractional reserve ratio. In other words, woman, you found $100. It just fell out of the sky. So you bring it to my bank, $100. You put it in the bank. I'm going to have to keep some of that money in case you come back to ask for it, but I'm not going to keep all of it. I'm going to want to make some money off that money by lending it out at an interest rate, okay? So I'm going to say my required reserve ratio is 10%. So I'm going to keep $10 of that money, and then the lendable amount would be $90. That's where you, sir, come in. You come to my bank and you say, I've got a brilliant idea for a new business. What is it? I'm going to change my name to Sven and make and offer a Sven's massage service. Okay? Build up my muscles so that I ripple and all of that. Well, I said, well, that's kind of a good idea. Okay. We'll lend you $90. You give her the $90 to build this, your facility. Okay? So you got $90 in your pocket, you bring it into my bank, and you kick it into my bank, $90. Well, I have to keep a required reserve of 10% of that. But now I've got $81, and you come in, and you say, I've got a business proposal. Okay, what's your business proposal? Well, I'm thinking, something along the line of eliminateyourannoyingneighbors.com. Exactly how did this work? We kill them. Sweet. Okay? So I lend you, I have $81, so I lend you that $81. I have to keep $8.10 of it, but then I have $72.90, I think. And then someone comes in to borrow from me. Look what's happened. The money supply is actually growing, and there's no more money. At the end of the day, how much will this account to? The total new money from just that $100 you put in there will be $1,000. How do I know that? Because the money multiplier is 1 over the required reserve ratio. So in this case, it's 1 over 0.10, which is 10 on the base, which was right there. $1,000 out of $100. So you see, the Fed can move this up and down 10% to 20%, which would slow down the growth of the money supply, drop it down to 5%, which would accelerate the growth of the money supply. It can do that. It's a meat cleaver. It is not something the Fed would use too often. Mostly the Fed uses it just to try to, if there's not very much confidence in the banking system, the Fed might put this up so the banks have to keep more in case everyone runs into the bank. If the economy is doing good and people are confident about banks, they'll edge it down. It was 5 years ago, easily, someone in an econ class of mine said, well, what is the real required reserve ratio? You use 10%. Is that what it is? I said, no, I don't know what it is, but I'll find out. So again, I called St. Louis. I called them then. He said, believe it or not, there is not one required reserve ratio. And I said, what? He said, no, there's actually three. He said, depending upon what tranche of money you're talking about that a bank is coming into a bank, for the first $10 million of money that a bank has in it, the required reserve ratio is zero. There is none. They can lend out every penny of that. And then, I can't remember what the tranches were. It was 10 to 100 million or something like that. It was like 6%, and then above 100 million, it was like 7%. It was in that range, I think, if I remember right. But it was kind of weird. I thought, okay, let's do the money multiplier when required reserve ratio is zero. 1 over 0, oh yeah, that's what makes the universe implode on your calculator. There is no required reserve ratio for that small amount. Their theory being that for small community banks, they want those banks to accelerate as fast as possible to help their communities grow and all of that. I guess that's how he kind of explained it to me anyway. But there you go. This is rarely used, and it's certainly not a good idea to use it to make the money supply grow and contract. It's really not a good idea because it's so blunt. You would use that more, as I said, for keeping banks solvent during bad times. Second one, the discount rate. The Fed lends money to banks. Now, until 2009, I would have told you the Fed, banks can go to the Fed and borrow money. Or they can borrow money from each other in what's called the federal funds market. In other words, banks lending each other money in an overnight interbank lending market. Think about it this way. I'm your daddy.
All right.
Okay?
Yeah.
Someday you'll make something of yourself. God knows, I keep hoping. But okay. Now, you've got a little problem and you need to borrow some money. $10,000. You need it tomorrow. Seriously, that's okay. I'm your daddy. These are your friends. A lot of them are rich. They're all related to Donald Trump. Okay? Now, Who are you going to go to? I'll lend you the money without much of an interest rate, a lower interest rate. They'll charge you more. But you need $10,000. You need it right now. Who are you going to go to? Your friends or to me?
Not you.
You got that right. I'll beat the shit out of you. Okay? You understand. I'll ask you a whole lot of questions. What the hell? You know, and you're going to have to explain that night in Bangkok and that that little incident and having to pay off government officials to get away. And you put the girl in the luggage and brought her back with you. And okay, it's better if you ask your friends, even though they're going to charge you more. You understand why banks don't go to the Fed historically, because they could borrow money at the discount window at the Fed. But if they did that, it's the government. So a lot of banks were more willing to go into that. And see, the thing, though, is that the Fed just sets the discount rate. Here it is. They'll push it up to slow down the economy. They'll push it down to bring the economy back up. It's more of a signal. It's like banks didn't go to use it, but it sort of said, this is the Fed sentiment. We pushed the interest rate up, so we're telling everyone that the economy is rolling a little too fast. Or we brought the interest rate down, so we're telling everyone that the economy is a little sluggish. It was more like a signal for decades. Most banks would go to the federal funds market. They would borrow from each other at a higher rate. But that federal funds market was supply and demand. Supply of money in the federal funds market, demand for money in the federal funds market. But then something strange happened. After the recession, when the recession hit in 2008, and it was a doozy. I mean, that was the worst one since the Great Depression, and it was scary, especially on one day in September, and I'll go into that here in a few minutes, when it all came to a head. But it was a really bad recession, and the Fed took the position, we're going to hand money out like candy. At the discount window, pretty much eventually the discount rate was zero. They were handing out money without interest rate, and they were shoveling in a secret program, they were just shoveling, a staggering, it's almost beyond belief. It was found out, it was discovered in 2010, accidentally by a news service that had gotten under the Freedom of Information Act emails from one of the banks involved. It turned out that one of the emails mentioned this backdoor program where the Fed was literally just shoveling, at that point, it had shoveled $7.7 trillion in the back door of the Big Ten banks. Just shoveled it in there. It didn't tell anyone it was doing it, so financial analysts like me were sitting saying, these banks are going to die. Look at their financials. Their financials are the financials of dead animals. And yet these banks just kept going and going. Citibank and all of those banks just kept going, and we looked like idiots. You told us to sell those banks, and those banks are still going. Yeah, I was trying to do fundamental analysis, and I have no idea. Then in 2010, it was discovered. The banks, along with the Treasury and the Federal Reserve, tried to get a judge to block the release by the news organization of what they'd found. The judge in Washington, D.C., an older woman, just said, oh, no, everyone needs to know this. Of course, it didn't matter. It blew open. The news organization thought they had the scoop of the century. No one cared. The bank, the program's still going on now, just shoveling money into the banks, these Big Ten, because they can't let those banks fail. And if they stop doing this, those banks will. You can't let a bank fail when it's got mortgages to foreclose. But anyway, discount rate is more useful now. And a lot of banks go to the Fed's discount window because the money is basically almost free there. The third one are the open market operations. The Fed essentially uses treasury bills with traders. And I'm going to do this more in the next lecture. I'll go through it in detail in the next lecture. But essentially the way it works is like this. The Federal Reserve has an open market committee. The seven governors and five bank presidents, district bank presidents, Now, four of the five serve on two-year rotating basis. The fifth one is the New York District Bank president, which has a permanent voting seat. The Federal Open Market Committee votes to push money into the economy or drain money out based on whether the economy is in recession or in inflation, pursuant to the 1970s law to help the economy maintain its stability. Okay. So essentially, the FOMC makes the decision and it communicates it to the domestic trading desk at the New York Fed, which is the permanent voting seat. And the domestic trading desk goes and tells the traders what they're to do. The traders have dollars and they have treasury bills. What they do is they go to banks, and if they're supposed to add money to the economy, now the banks have tier one capital, dollars and treasury bills, and if the Fed wants to pump money into the economy, the traders buy treasuries and pay for them with money, adding money to the economy. That's growing the economy. That's what we've been doing since 2008, trying to keep the economy alive. Now, on the other hand, if the Fed needs to drain liquidity, it would do the opposite. It would sell treasuries and then to the bank, and the banks would pay money, and that would pull money out of the Fed funds market. That's that in a nutshell, and I'll do it in more detail the next time. But the point here is that this sets the stage for the last thing I want to tell you about today. And this is a doozy. It's worth it for you to have put up with this exceedingly boring lecture just for what I'm going to show you here at the end. Try this. Madam, what's money?
Paper.
Well, let's try this. So suppose that he doesn't have any money, but he can kill and dress a moose, and you like moose meat. Would you take moose meat for an apple pie? You make a damn good apple pie. He makes good, damn good moose meat. Would you trade? Maybe. Well, he's generous. He gives you a whole flank of moose, you know, with an antler rack, too, to put on over your dining room set, right next to the Elvis plates on the wall. Money is whatever is commonly accepted in exchange for something else. Money is anything that is commonly and generally accepted in exchange for something else. That's three. There are three kinds of money. The first one is types of money. First one is barter money. Barter money is the moose. It's the apple pie. You could use your love for money or not. You could use your expertise in hacking into websites like Ashley Madison. I mean, money is whatever we accept in exchange. It doesn't have to be anything physical. Now, barter money has as much intrinsic value as it does in exchange. In other words, you could eat the moose or you could trade it. You could give yourself love, or you could trade your love. You could hack into your own parents' website, or you could sell it to the... Don't do that. It's nasty. Barter money is the ancient kind of money. And we still use it to this day all the time, especially in some economies in the world. I've been places where they had no use for physical money, for paper money. What am I supposed to do with this? You know, give me something I can use. Barter money has always been there. The next kind of money is what's called commodity money or metal money. Like gold, silver, platinum, copper. Those kinds of money, they still have intrinsic value. You can use a metal for something. Matter of fact, we find many, many examples through history of money, of what was clearly was money that was turned into a weapon, like a spear point or something like that. I mean, metal can be used for things other. Gold, for example, it actually is usable. You can use it for things, but it can also be used in trade. So in other words, it still has some intrinsic value. The last one is fiat money, or the way we used to pronounce it, fiat money. Now they pronounce it fiat. That's this stuff. It is money only because of decree of the sovereign. It is not money for any other reason. Can you tell me what that says down there?
Under there?
Yeah, no, right here.
Federal Reserve Bank of...
Oh, this one. This right
note
here.
Is legal tender for all debts, public and private.
In other words, you have to accept it. By decree of the sovereign, it has no other use. Well, I suppose you could use it as toilet paper. You know, I once went to a really it was a real fancy corporate Christmas dinner. I was invited, an invited guest, and I saw the president got up there with this cigar, and he talked about how incredibly well they were doing, and I thought, he's going to go there. He pulled out a $100 bill, and he lit it, and he lit his cigar with it, and I thought, yep, he went there, and then he just tossed the $100 in this ashtray, and I'm like, God damn, that's good money. I can have friends. But anyway, fiat. Now here's the thing is there's also a liquidity thing going on. Liquidity is the efficiency with which you can convert an asset into another asset. The efficiency with which you can convert one asset into another asset. Specifically, liquidity is oftentimes measured against money. How fast can you turn this into money? So in other words, someday you're going to own a McMansion. And it's a very valuable thing, but try to get a cheeseburger at McDonald's through the drive-thru with it. In other words, it has extremely low liquidity. Treasury bills have extremely high liquidity because they're accepted everywhere. Traveler's checks have high liquidity because they're accepted everywhere. Dollar bills have incredible liquidity because they're accepted everywhere. You can rapidly turn a dollar bill into a burger. You can rapidly turn a treasury bill, it can be traded out within seconds. Traveler's checks, you can use those internationally. I don't know how many people even use those anymore. But so here we go. Moving to the last piece of this story. Let me do something here. The money supply, how we measure it. The first one no one talks about, M0. That's called base. It's coins and currency only. The base money supply, coins and currency only. And again, it's one no one talks about. I'm one of the financial economists who keeps an eye on it because it's done some pretty strange things in recent times. The one that is first to be mentioned often is M1. This is M0 plus demand deposits. In other words, bank checking accounts and traveler's checks, spelled with two L's, unfortunately. Those used to be kind of big thing. And have any of you ever used traveler's checks? Are they even? I know, right? I mean, they're still in the definition of M1 because they are so liquid, but I mean, it's like, who uses them anymore? So in other words, base currency plus these things. Now, interestingly enough, when I say demand deposits, I'm talking about checking accounts at real banks. The checking accounts at credit unions are not in M1 because they are another animal called a negotiable order of withdrawal. Theoretically, a credit union does not have to honor them for a few days, so they are not as liquid. A demand deposit, a check, is bearer demand. I can walk in with your check to your bank and say, you need to give me this money now with proper ID, and they have to give it to me. Now, credit unions almost would never do this, but theoretically, because they're those now accounts, negotiable order of withdrawal, they're not part of M1. Interestingly enough, it used to be the case that credit unions and things like that couldn't even spell their checks with a CK. They had to use a QUE. I think they don't do that anymore. M2 is M1, all of this stuff, plus those negotiable order of withdrawal things, credit union stuff, and smaller time deposits, up to a couple of million dollars. In other words, CDs, small CDs. And then there's the massive one. The Fed stopped reporting this in 2006. And I'm going to show you why in just a minute. It's M3. It's M2 plus large time deposits plus euro dollars. Euro dollars are our dollars in other central banks. Those little dollar bills that I was drawing up there in the People's Bank of China, those are euro dollars. Euro dollars are our dollars in other banks around the world, waiting to come back here to be spent. Because remember, a dollar bill can't be spent anywhere but in the United States. So now, with that in mind, I'm going to show you something here. As I told you, I was a writer for many years on economic and finance matters, and I garnered a lot of this unhappiness because of what I wrote, both from the conservatives and the liberals. And let me tell you a brief story as setting the backdrop for this. On September 15th of 2008, when the sun came up on the east coast of the United States, the banks woke up and got to work, and the Fed people got to, well, Federal Reserve people got to work. And right away, well, not right away, I think it was just a little bit of delay, the techs at the Fed started noticing the L's, as I've called them before, started noticing abnormally large withdrawals of money market funds, in other words, highly liquid money from banks on the East Coast. You know, figure, well, something's going on, who knows. The withdrawals were unusually large. And they, you know, sometimes there's a surge, someone on another side of the planet needs a pile of money, whatever. Well, the surge didn't stop. Unusually large withdrawals were happening repeatedly, minute by minute, hour by hour. By about 9:30 in the morning, the alarm bells were really starting to scream. We are talking about, at that point, approaching $400 billion of money market funds were simply being pulled out of money market funds in the banks. What that would mean. Okay, well, obviously, we've got to see this money showing up in a price spike on gold. Someone's freaking out and buying gold. Nothing. Nowhere. No commodity. Nowhere. 10 o'clock, the Fed met in a very unusual session. We need to stop this because what is the amount now? $550 billion. Okay, shut down the money markets. No one can withdraw any more money at this point. So they stopped allowing money market money to be withdrawn. Tiny amounts for normal people and businesses, sure. But the big ones, stop it. Just shut it down. It ain't going to happen. Well, by that time, well, that would have meant the Fed stopped it probably about an hour, hour and a half before it would have collapsed the entire global economy. That would have meant your ATM didn't work, your paycheck was gone, everything you had in your savings was gone, and that would have clocked around the world, and as the sun rose around the rest of the world, the financial system of the entire planet would have just gone into a crater. The financial equivalent of watching a nuclear explosion wrap the planet. The Congress was called into special session, closed the doors. At one point, the doors, one congressman, he's kind of a firebrand, kind of an idiot sometimes, he called out to the Speaker of the House at that time, Nancy Pelosi, said, "Madam Chairman, is this House under martial law?" She didn't answer him, but he knew very well it was because they couldn't leave there. Hank Paulson, the federal, the Treasury chairman, and a number of officials from the Fed, Ben Bernanke and those kinds of guys, all came to the Congress and said, "This is really, really bad. Something has broken. Something has broken that is global in scope. We need to solve it before we open these doors." Now, some of the representatives there who had been burned by the hyperbole after 9/11, you know, we must pass authoritarian laws. This time they said, no, 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 you got to show us what happened. We're not going to pass this kind of legislation unless you show us why this is, what's going on, why, and you give us an honest story instead of the bull crap you gave us the last time you told us there was a crisis. We had to do exactly what you said. Well, what caused that? Let me show you something. One of the articles, I wrote a series of articles warning that this was going to happen. I was writing them. The last article I wrote was in June of 2008. It was called The Gospel of Impending Doom. I showed exactly how things were going, what was going to happen, and, of course, I was roundly ignored. Well, I'll show you the money supplies. These M1, M2, M3. Now remember, they stack. So what is happening with M2 includes what's happening with M3. What happens in M3 includes what's happening with M2. Well, here we go. People say, well, what are those spikes? Well, those are 9/11. The Fed pushed a lot of money to the banks in big trucks in case everyone panicked, and then they pulled it out once they figured out people weren't going to panic after 9/11. So ignore that. Let's see what's going on here. Look at M1. That's the money businesses and people use. Now, remember, the economy was growing, not spectacularly, 2.5%, 3%. But look what was happening. As we come toward 2008, the Fed had closed down the growth of the money supply, the M1, the one we, small businesses and people, use. It was no longer growing. And as the economy grew, the amount of liquidity in the economy was going down relative to it. That was what was causing us to come toward a liquidity crisis. Now notice that M2 was growing. These are growth rates. These aren't actual levels. These are growth rates. Notice that M2's growth was fairly stable, but it was growing year over year at about 5%. But the one that was the problem was this one. The reason the Fed was trying to clamp down on M1 was because M3 was out of control. As a matter of fact, the Fed declared no one uses M3, so we're going to stop publishing the numbers. A service I use, Shadow Government Statistics, statistics continued to calculate it. And this was what was happening. We were buying so much from overseas, in terms of goods from China, oil from other countries, you name it, that these euro dollars were skyrocketing in central banks around the world. The Fed was trying to control that growth of M3 by suppressing growth of M1. The result was that by the time you get out here to September, I published my article right before the crisis. The economy just simply buckled. It just popped like that because there was no liquidity at the bottom where everyone is. Because everyone is so concerned with the wealthy, with the corporations and the banks, they didn't notice that you're killing us. And of course, it came back to bite us. Now, a couple of things. If you go to the Federal Reserve now and you look at this chart, M1, M2, M3, you'll never find M3. But with the other M1, M2, they'll show you that there was a recession. They'll show you a gray band here. I pulled this chart, except for this part right here in the annotations, I pulled this off the Fed back before they said there was a recession that justified the tax cuts. Okay, last thing to show you. You remember I told you about this really cool spike here? What had happened was 9/11, there was a great deal of concern that people were going to totally freak out. They were going to run to their banks to get all their money out, put it under the mattress, and the banks wouldn't have the money because they don't keep everyone's all the money people put in, required reserve ratio and all of that. So when the terrorist attack happened, the Fed moved out in this massive military almost operation, trucks from every district bank just shoveling money into the vaults of banks around the country. And then after they figured out, oh, people aren't freaking out, they brought the money back in. But there's a problem. What day did the terrorist attacks happen? September 11th, right? Wait. M1. This was early in 2001. Look at the spike. That would have been the first week of September. Then at the end of the first week. On September 11th, it finished a spike that had been going on for a week before. Do you see it? The Fed was driving the trucks the week before 9/11 happened, filling them up. You see it, don't you? This is the Fed's chart. So what does that mean? There's no such thing as a conspiracy. There's just a story that no one will tell. That's all I have for you. Go home.